It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at the emerging conflict between House Speaker John Boehner and some conservative groups over the federal budget.
But first, in 2008, the United States came the closest it has ever come to running a female major party nominee for president. Hillary Clinton was ultimately defeated by President Obama, but her campaign sparked a conversation about the prospects of a woman as president of the United States.
A lot of other countries around the world have been led by women, Nicaragua to the Philippines, South Korea to Australia. The United States hasn't done it yet, but why?
Our next guest put that question to a collection of interviews she did with leaders from around the country. Marianne Schnall is the founder of Feminist.com and the author of Daring to Be Ourselves. Her new book, the book we'll be talking about, is called What Will It Take to Make a Woman President? Marianne, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I want to start out by talking about your daughter, because daughters come up a lot in this book, and your daughter, the way you describe it, was part of, at least part of, the impetus for it, because she asked you back in, I think, 2008, a very simple question: why isn't a woman president of the United States? And it was that sort of simple, obvious question that set you off on this journey.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, sometimes I guess it's just sort of these questions that can come, you know, out of the mouth of babes that kind of wake you up to just, you know, it's a very simple, innocent question, and yet it's a good one. You know, she asked, why, you know, haven't we ever had a woman president? And it was on the heels of Barack Obama becoming our first African-American president. So it was a logical question for her to ask. And, you know, I found it, even though, you know, I've run a women's nonprofit and I write a lot about women's issues, sort of challenging to answer. And so it sort of stuck in my head, and I decided to explore it in this book. And, you know, I think the reason why it was so hard for me to answer at that point is because there's not sort of one simple, you know, answer to that question. It does require looking at it through a variety of different experiences and perspectives. It touches on a lot of interconnecting issues. So it definitely was an interesting question in and of itself, but coming also from at the time she was 8 years old, what that means for, you know, girls that that there isn't a woman president and that they perhaps can't imagine themselves becoming president and oftentimes in leadership positions.
So when you set out to interview, and you interview a wide variety of people, I mean, there's politicians, there are entertainers, there are men, there are women, there are people we know, people who are less well known. So a lot of people in this book, when you call them up to, you know, sort of set up the interview and get things set, was this something, a topic that people were really kind of ready to talk about?
Unbelievably so. I mean, just so you get a sense of it, I had always anticipated that I would interview 20 people. And as I set out to do the book, what wound up happening is that the people that I interviewed would suggest additional people for me to interview and oftentimes give me their contact information. So not only were they excited to talk about it, they were really also seeing it almost like as a collective effort. And so I wound up interviewing nearly 60 people, which is why there's actually an ebook edition of the book with 19 additional interviews. So I think that says a lot. And I actually, there's a lot of interest in me doing additional interviews. So we're in the works to possibly do an online version where we can continue the conversation. It feels like it's a very timely topic.
And so as you went through the interviews, and I should point out that the book is it's you asking the questions, the guests answering the questions, and it sounds very much in their words. As you started doing these interviews, and then as you ended, did you feel as though you were getting some clarity on the answers to these questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was really, you know, it was such a diversity of perspectives that I wound up sort of soliciting. So it's, you know, everybody from, you know, artists like Melissa Etheridge to, you know, politicians like Olympia Snowe and Nancy Pelosi and men like Nicholas Kristof and, you know, Republicans and Democrats and young and old. So, you know, by the end of it, everybody obviously had different takes on it, but there were definitely some common themes that were emerging, you know, whether they were around the need to encourage women and girls to see themselves as leaders, or about the role of the media in terms of how it depicts women and girls, but also how it depicts, you know, female leaders. There was talks about campaign finance reform. There was the need to also support working women and families, and the need for just sort of cultural change in general in terms of, like, the strict gender roles that there are that not only negatively impact women, but also negatively impact men. I mean, that was also something that came out of this need to just kind of sort of redefine what our expectations are of both genders and what we're capable of, and, you know, sort of the cultural possibilities of change.
And so it's interesting because at the beginning of the interview, you said, you know, this as you asked this seemingly obvious question, it started getting very complex for you very quickly. But it sounds as though as you worked your way through this interview process that the answers were still complex, that there's not an easy answer to the question, why hasn't there been a woman president yet?
Yeah, I mean, people still say that to me, and I'm not sure that, you know, there is an easy answer, although I think the hopeful finding that I feel has come out of it is that people can now imagine it. It feels that it is more possible and that we're making a lot of progress. And I think, you know, part of it, what was important to me in doing this book was also the reframing of this as not a, quote, women's issue. I think that looking at this as an issue of the need for diversity and having a reflective democracy, which, of course, means not only gender diversity, but just diversity in general, and just how we all will benefit having diversity, and women are half of the population, and just, you know, we're facing really difficult problems in this country and around the world. And I think, as someone had said to me, you know, we can't afford to waste half our talent. We need all hands on deck. So this sense that this is something that, you know, would be of benefit, again, I think it was Nicholas Kristof who said to me, not just to the women of America, but to all of America.
And it's difficult to have this discussion without mentioning Hillary Clinton. You know, she came awfully close in 2008. 2016, all of a sudden, is right around the corner. Is this did she come up a lot in the course of your interviews?
Yeah, I mean, I might have brought her up a few times, but for the most part, her name just naturally surfaced. I think the reason why Hillary's name came up so much was, one, yes, she is definitely like our first visual. We can kind of imagine it happening. She did come really close in 2008. Right now, of course, her name is everywhere. But also, it just, the sense, and this was from, you know, a lot of people I spoke to, Republican, Democrat alike, that she may be kind of uniquely positioned to break that milestone. I think it was Kirsten Gillibrand, you know, the New York senator, and Nancy Pelosi, who both said that because of all of her experience, she would be the, quote, you know, most well-prepared president in history. She also, you know, she toughed it out through a really hard campaign in 2008. There was a lot of sexist coverage, you know, at that time that, you know, was sort of an interesting thing for us to all witness and learn from. So I do think that, you know, her name in this book sort of looms large as being, you know, our first visual. A lot of other names came up as possible contenders, but there's just, you know, no question that she's the most visible one at this time.
And it was interesting, you mentioned Nicholas Kristof, and I think he's the one who said somewhere that he would, you know, if you would have made him bet before 2008, he would have bet there would be a woman president before an African-American president.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say about, you know, the state of women politics and where we are right now?
Yeah, I think that there is a little bit of a sense that, you know, we're further along than we are. First of all, I think sometimes some of the, you know, the sexism in our culture, it's almost like it's become so subliminal that it's kind of just accepted. And so we may not realize that some of these things that we would think would be so possible, you know, we still have ways to go. You know, a lot of people pointed out the fact that, you know, it wasn't so long ago that women didn't even have the right to vote, which is pretty astounding when you think about it. So, you know, the progress has definitely been slow, but I think, you know, for the most part, it is something that we need to be more proactive on. I think just recognizing that the numbers are so low, you named, you know, a lot of other countries where there have been women leaders, the numbers are not just low in terms of, you know, I think it's that we're 77th in the world in terms of women on national legislatures, but also, you know, 18% of Congress. And then even in the corporate world, the numbers are just as low. You know, women hold only 14% of executive officer positions and 16% of board seats. So I think that when you say that to people, people have sort of more of a sense that we're farther along than we are and that there is more, you know, parity. So I think that I'm hoping that this book sort of also just, you know, creates more awareness for the reality that we may need to sort of consciously work on this to get to that parity.
All right, lots to talk about. We're talking with Marianne Schnall about her new book, What Will It Take to Make a Woman President?
And we want to hear your answer to that question. What will it take to make a female president? Do you think it will happen soon or not for quite a while? Why haven't we had one yet? And what do you think a woman president would mean to Americans in general and maybe to young girls? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're back with Marianne Schnall. Her new book is What Will It Take to Make a Woman President?
And we'd like to hear your thoughts, too. What will it take to make a female president of the United States? Is this something that you think you are going to see, that you're going to witness in your lifetime? Why haven't we had one yet? 800-642-1234 is the number if you would like to join in. 800-642-1234. Marianne Schnall, before the break, we were talking about some of the statistics there, and I remember in one of the interviews, and I can't remember who said it, but you asked the question, as you did throughout the book, and the answer was, well, one of the things to think about is that women didn't have the right to participate. They didn't have suffrage for, you know, half the life of the Republic, and so kind of starting from a hole right there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, and that's really like a startling fact. So I think if you look at it from that, you know, sense, it takes a while to change some of these, you know, perceptions and to sort of erase some of the, you know, the sexism that is in our culture. Because if you think about that, women weren't even considered, you know, able to even cast their vote. You know, the idea of becoming then president of the United States, you know, seems obviously a big stretch to that. However, you know, I think that, you know, there was a difference in perspective when I would ask the question, where do you think we are in terms of the status of women today? There were a lot of people who, you know, felt we're making really great progress, and I think you can see a lot of signs of that. But there was definitely a sense that things are sort of really kind of very slow and stagnating. Like, it's just, for whatever reason, it's just, you know, I think it was Sheryl Sandberg who points out to the fact, even in the corporate world, like these numbers just, they don't rise above 20%. And so, you know, again, even though we may have come a long way since those days when we couldn't even vote, you know, that really has a big impact if our voices and visions and, you know, are not being, you know, part of the decision making in this country. So I think that, you know, as I said, there's been a lot of progress, but I do think that becoming aware and looking for what are the, you know, structural and other barriers that still exist so that we can try to work on them.
800-642-1234 if you would like to join in the discussion. And let's go to the listeners right now. Let's start with Dan, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. First, I'm very happy to hear you discussing this. But second, I was curious about Marianne's thoughts in creating that specific title. I thought there might be other ways to phrase a similar topic, and I wondered why she chose that specific title, Making a Woman President, and what will it take?
Yeah, you know, that's always been really tricky. That's actually kind of a good question. It actually, this whole book came out of the first manifestation of this book was for an article that I did for CNN, where I sort of worked in this question into, I was covering an event, and I wound up weaving this question into some of my questions for some of the people that were there at the time, and it was everybody from Sheryl Sandberg to Jane Fonda to Arianna Huffington. It was supposed to be on this little vertical at CNN. It went up going on the homepage and getting so much feedback. So that was the title for the CNN piece. And then when it came to do the actual book, you know, it was hard to think of something that was, you know, kind of eye-catching because there's so many books on women and leadership and women in politics. And I guess it's, you know, coming from that question that, you know, my daughter had asked, there was just something very symbolic about it. And it just, as I said, it was kind of this lens into all of the prongs of this issue. So, you know, I always try to say it in the same breath, though, you know, conversations about women leadership and power, because you're right, it's about much more than that. It's just that is a symbol. But, you know, at the same time, you know, it's the publisher seemed to like the title, and it does seem like, especially in the timely moment, which I did not plan, a little bit with all the buzz around Hillary, I think it's why it is actually getting the type of attention it is.
Let's go back to Madison right now and talk to Steve. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good topic. And first impression, just as a guy who listens to radio, talk radio too much, is that Hillary Clinton may be history in the sense that she's pretty much compromised, bought, and paid for by the same old white guy network who have given us Romney and Obama and who have pretty much maintained the reins of power over the past 40 to 60 years. So I think that even if elected, she would offer no significant change for the 49% or the 99%. And my suggestion, almost devil's advocate, is that you make an effort to get Michelle Obama to run for president. Mm. That's my ignorant impression that she would have 55% of the vote right away against anyone the GOP might present.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call. And Hillary Clinton, of course, everybody talking about. Michelle Obama, possibilities there?
You know, the funny thing is her name did come up a few times. I think she's been pretty clear. I've heard her asked point blank by, I think it was Barbara Walters, that she absolutely did not think that that was ever going to be a position that was of interest to her. But I think it's great that we're having those conversations about what type of women are out there that we would want to or we could see, you know, holding that office. So I think, again, I'm always very careful to not too closely associate this with Hillary. Again, she's a big, you know, visual, and she's obviously understandably related to this topic. But I think the idea is to start thinking about who's out there that we could envision there. And again, it's also just about, in general, having more women in all positions of leadership, not just in politics, but throughout all sectors of society.
You know, during the course of your interviews, was there anybody who was like particularly pessimistic about the idea of a woman being elected president?
You know, I can't think of anybody offhand, but there were definitely some people who felt like that it would be, you know, were we really ready? What was going to happen in terms of even the media coverage? You know, and that was something that was of concern in the 2008, you know, campaign. So, you know, I think there was definitely a little bit of skepticism about. And a lot of this, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean that just because, you know, Hillary or anybody else would run. Again, this isn't just about electing, you know, any woman. It's also about who is the best woman, who is the best person, you know, to fill that job. And so there's a lot of, you know, factors that I can't predict. But the overall sense is that people were hopeful. I think the one thing I would say is that I do remember one or two people I'd ask the question, do you foresee having a woman president in your lifetime? And some of them, especially some of the people I interviewed like past 50, would say, well, if Hillary runs, if not, I'm not so sure. That was a little discouraging to me in the sense that, you know, that she may be the most likely, most poised person to break that milestone. And if not, then people become a little bit more pessimistic about that possibility. So in that sense, you know, that's where I would hear a little pessimism.
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is the idea of women in other countries leading those. There are lots of examples. You know, I think of Margaret Thatcher, Angela Merkel. Is there something particular about the U.S. that we haven't had a woman just yet or as president just yet? Or are they just, is it because of the difference in the way that they're elected or what?
Yeah, I'm not really, you know, sure about that either. I mean, that's come up a few times. And I mean, it's always different depending on, you know, what country. And some have quotas. I mean, some even have systems that, you know, it's a matter of, you know, if the leader dies and, you know, it's the daughter, it's the wife. I mean, there's a lot of other ways that, that women have gotten into that position in other countries. But I think, you know, for the most part, I do think that in the U.S. where we think we're so progressive, we're not as progressive as we think we are in a lot of ways. And again, it's the pipeline, too. I think you have to look at the fact that, you know, while it was really history-making to have, you know, 20 women in the U.S. Senate, I remember saying that fact to my other daughter, and she was like, really, 20? I mean, you know, 20 is 20% or 18% of Congress is not really something to cheer about. So,
and I hate to interrupt you, but we've got a really quick call we'd like to squeeze in. Clara's with us from Madison.
Hi.
Hi, Clara. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm a high schooler in Madison, and I've been thinking about this kind of thing recently a lot. And I think when women go into politics or any position of leadership, they're often seen as, like, very cold and, like, not feminine. And if they do become emotional, it's blamed on their gender. And a lot of times, like, women, the media will focus more on, like, what they're wearing or, like, how they look than what they're actually
And I think we'll have to leave it there, Clara. Thanks so much. Marianne, we're going to have to leave it there with you. Thanks so much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Marianne Schnall has been with us, and we have been talking about her book, What Will It Take to Make a Woman President?
Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
The budget deal worked out by Representative Paul Ryan and Senator Patty Murray passed the U.S. House yesterday. Now it's expected to go to the Senate next week, removing the threat of a government shutdown for at least the next 2 years.
But Speaker of the House John Boehner was not pleased with criticism from the Tea Party wing of his party and organizations like Heritage Action and others. Joining us to discuss the Speaker's criticism of those critics is Dan DeSalvo. He's Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership and Assistant Professor of Political Science at the City College of New York. Dan, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you.
So as I mentioned, Speaker Boehner lashed out at some of his critics in his own party, saying, quote, they've lost credibility, they're misleading their followers. What do you think led the Speaker to make this criticism of those groups?
Well, I think Speaker Boehner, since the results of the 2012 election came in, has had the most difficult job in Washington. Mm. In a sense, you had 2008 and 2010, and 2012 didn't give a signal of where the country wanted to go, and this has led Speaker Boehner to be this linchpin of what's going to happen in Washington, and he's trying to govern a very factionalized Republican Party in the House. So in some ways, it's surprising that he's kept his cool this long and not expressed any frustration with these groups, which have, you know, in some sense, mobilized against any potential deal or action that could be crafted under divided government.
Seems like the core question that's making his job so difficult is the idea of controlling the House in divided government. Do you get what you can in a compromise, and Paul Ryan's made that argument about this budget, or hold out for more and just hew closer to principle at the expense of compromise, and Senator Marco Rubio has been making that argument. How do you balance those two ideas of how to manage a divided government?
And I think that is, you put your finger on exactly what's made Speaker Boehner's job so difficult, is in a sense, there are two stark alternatives, and one really has to choose. And there's the Tea Party faction of his party, in a sense, many of the activist groups, Heritage Action and others, by taking a strong stand, you know, can score some political points and can win donors and rev up certain parts of the Republican Party base. At the same time, the government needs to continue to function. It needs to continue to work. And if it doesn't, that's going to reflect poorly on Republicans who will be seen as holding up the show, as we saw with the government shutdown just this past fall.
And speaking of that government shutdown, do you think that was on Paul Ryan's mind, on Speaker Boehner's mind, going into this this budget negotiation, wanting to not get that kind of blame that they got leading up to that shutdown?
I think that they absolutely had to consider it, looking at how far the party's poll numbers had sunk in the wake of the shutdown, and it's sort of pointlessness. Now, Republicans were also bailed out, and they could have even been capitalizing more on the botched rollout of Obamacare. During the shutdown drama, the beginnings of stories in the press and so on about those difficulties that the Democrats were having were beginning to come out, and they couldn't take advantage of those. And I think Ryan and Boehner would like to focus energy a little bit on the problems on the other side.
I always wonder when we hear stories of rifts within a party, whether Democrats or Republicans, if this is really a substantial thing that's going to cause trouble for the party down the road, or if it's a blip that we in the media get really excited about.
Well, I've studied factions in American political parties and wrote a book on the subject, so I take the view that these factions, not in every case, and sometimes they are just a blip on the media radar screen, but sometimes they do end up being more substantial and in influencing really what the government does and how one party or the other develops. And in the case of the Tea Party at this point, I think it is a really substantial movement with an organizational infrastructure that can endure at least for a few years and a few election cycles.
But do they pull together, say, in the 2014 elections, and this tiff now won't be a big deal then? Or do you think it's going to be an issue, say, in Republican primaries?
I think it will be an issue in some Republican primaries. So those candidates, you can see this already playing out, especially at the level of many of the senators who are up for re-election, including Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. They're worried about primary challenges coming from the Tea Party wing of the party. So I think that division is there, and that's more problematic at the state-level senatorial elections. But in many of the House elections already, you know, the districts that are conservative enough to elect Tea Party members have already done so.
Looking ahead at what this might mean for compromise and bipartisanship in Congress, there's been a lot of talk, of course, about gridlock, especially the shutdown. Does this one compromise, not the grand bargain some people were looking for, but do you think it's an opening for maybe more cases of compromise between Democrats and Republicans?
Right now, given the level of party polarization, I would be betting on it not being a harbinger of great compromises coming down in the future. I think what will moderate the parties in any way are probably decisive signals on the part of Americans when it comes to elections, first here in 2014 and then the presidential election in 2016 that will indicate a direction that's in a sense break or weaken the deadlock or gridlock that's occurring in Washington right now. And then, of course, this can be shifted when some new crisis comes down the pipe that hasn't been foreseen by anyone.
Turning to the other faction, and maybe that's too strong a word, in the Republican Party, there has been some grumbling from establishment Republicans, is the term sometimes used, campaign donors not affiliated with a Tea Party network. Are they excited, do you think, happy to see Speaker Boehner calling out the Tea Party groups and thinking that it's their chance to regain the momentum within their own party?
I think most of those people I don't think that the antagonism has become such that what they would like to see is a more unified party that is an effective governing party. So the tension here is partly between campaigning and governing. The Tea Party has been quite effective as a campaign vehicle of mobilizing energy for the Republicans. But many of the, say, more establishment Republicans also want an agenda that they can govern on. So I doubt that they're cheering on the speaker to foment conflict within the party, because ultimately it makes the Republicans' task of trying to become the majority party more difficult.
Before we let you go, we wanted to get your thoughts on PolitiFact. That's the fact-checking program started by the Tampa Bay Times, I think. They fact-check statements by politicians. They always give a lie of the year. They gave the award this year to President Obama, saying, if you like your health care plan, you can keep it. That's under the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned the Affordable Care Act earlier. What are your thoughts on that?
I probably think that they were... that was far and away the best candidate for their award. You know, in some respects, this was a major strategic error on the part of the president and his team to allow this phrase to be in so many of his speeches when it was widely known and especially voiced by critics when it was first said a while ago that this wasn't true and this wasn't going to play out quite this way, and many of Obama's own staff knew this. They should have, and in part, Obama was ill-served by, in a sense, the media, who've been more favorable to the president. They should have picked up on this and listened to some of the critics on this point, and the president wouldn't then be confronted with this now, and he would have been confronted with it right when he first said it.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Dan DeSalvo. He's senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for State and Local Leadership, assistant professor of political science at the City College of New York. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's the holiday season, which for many people means exchanging baked treats, such as cookies.
So for Food Friday, we thought we'd focus on Christmas cookies and other holiday baking with a true expert. Anna Thomas Bates is with us. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section. And you can find her writing on babbel.com and at Edible Madison. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a question that vexes me every time I bake with butter. How soft is soft when we're softening our butter for baking?
Well, it's a great question. I have a lot of people ask me why are there cookies after they're finished baking just puddles of, just turn into puddles. They just spread out, and it's likely because your butter was too soft. And I'm guilty of this as well. I'll plan to make cookies. I'll put my butter on the counter in the morning, and by the afternoon, that's when I get around to it. By then, your butter is too soft. It's not going to be able to cream up and capture a lot of air, and it's that air beaten into the butter that gives you really nice structure. So really, you don't need that long. If you have a whole stick of butter, it can soften up in about a half hour. Otherwise, I get it out right before I bake, and I actually cut it up into small slices, put it into the mixer, and by the time I'm ready to get around to it, after putting together the flour, it's the perfect softness to beat up.
I guess that's my problem. I never use the mixer. It frightens me. So I just use a fork, and if I don't have it really soft, my wrist kind of falls apart after stabbing at it for 20 minutes or
so.
Well,
you are old school. You should get at least an electric hand mixer, but if you've been a good little boy, you should get yourself a stand mixer because it's really an easy way to make really good cookies.
I'll put that on my list.
All right, and we'll put in a good word to Santa as well for that. I want to start with a broader philosophical question. You know, cookies during the holiday season are almost like the perfect thing to make because they come in so many shapes, so many flavors, so many sizes, and everybody in the family can help.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, who doesn't like a cookie? And if you don't like one kind of cookie, there's going to be another kind of cookie that you're going to enjoy. And there's not a lot of technical ability or a fuss to it. You know, you really dump everything into a mixer or a bowl and use a fork like Rob, and you mix it all up and plop it onto a baking sheet, and then just don't bake it too long, which is my second big tip. Overdone cookies are no good.
So let's talk about that, because having baked cookies myself many times, I am a victim of having baked too long. How do you make sure you don't do that? How do you make sure you wind up with a nice, you know, crisp on the bottom but not burnt?
Sure. Well, your first batch is going to be your test batch. Usually you're doing multiple trays of cookies in one batch. And the basic rule of thumb is if you can smell the cookie baking, it's ready to come out of the oven and probably was ready to come out about a minute earlier. So take a peek in, look through the window. When your cookie looks just done on top, almost underbaked but not raw, and is just slightly golden around the edges, that's when it's ready to come out. Let it cool on the baking sheet for 1 or 2 minutes, and then go ahead and use a nice spatula and take it over onto a cooling rack, and they'll firm up right away.
Now, the flagship of the holiday cookie, of the Christmas cookie, is the sugar cutout cookie. That's the one I always steer toward when it's on the platter. What advice do you have on making those as good as you can?
Sure. With a sugar cutout cookie, one of my best tips is after you cut out the cookie and have it all laid out on the tray ready to bake, pop it into the freezer for a couple minutes. And then when you bake it, it's going to hold its shape really nicely and not puff up or spread out.
So wait, after you cut it into the shapes, it goes in the freezer for a couple?
Yes. So So cut it into the shapes, put it on the baking tray, and then just slide it into the freezer for a little while.
This explains everything. I'm taking notes here. Of course, now after the cookie is done, I mean, some people prefer a plain cookie. I am not
wrong.
One of those people. I prefer something a little more festive, something with more calories on it, perhaps. Give me some ideas about making something attractive and yet simple.
Sure. If you want to go really basic, before you actually bake the cookie, you can buy something called sanding sugar, which is a nice colored, sparkly sugar. You can get white as well. And you sprinkle that onto the cookie, and then you bake it. And then it comes out already decorated and sparkly and pretty and colorful. Otherwise, just make a basic icing. And I like to pick shapes that you can ice all in one color and they still look good. So like a snowflake, a star, a Christmas tree. You know, you don't have to get fancy with a lot of different colors icings unless you want to. And then after that, you can add a few embellishments. Like for a green Christmas tree, you can add just a couple of those red sugar beads. And there you have ornaments. Or a little red nose for a Rudolph. Or for a snowflake, just white sanding sugar looks really great on top of white icing. So you can be very, very simple, but have a really attractive cookie.
Our producer, Galen, is getting worked up about frosting over there. He says he's wondering about soft versus hard frosting. He says nobody likes hard frosting. It's got to be soft.
You know, I actually have, I'm middle of the road. I don't like the super soft frosting because then it just kind of makes a big mess when you try to pack it up. And I don't like the royal icing, which is the really hard icing that, you know, professional decorators use because it doesn't taste well. And I actually have a recipe on my blog where it's just powdered sugar, a little bit of milk, and a tiny bit of honey or corn syrup. And it goes on thin, and it stays pliable, but it will dry enough within a few hours that you can actually stack cookies without messing them up. So I kind of go middle of the road with the frosting versus icing debate.
And speaking of stacking cookies, you know, it's one thing to have them in the jar or something, but these are going to be out for family and friends to see. How do you? I just put them in a pile, but I've been advised by several people close to me that's not the way to do business. So give me some tips.
Sure. If you really want to have a nice platter, if you're going to make more than one cookie, and you don't have to, if you've got a really great family recipe or you're really good at a single cookie, make a whole bunch of those and give those away. But if you're going to put together a platter, it's kind of like designing a menu. You want to have complementary and contrasting flavors and textures. You know, always want to have something chocolate. You always want something with a little bit of color, like a sugar cutout cookie. I think something with dried fruits and nuts are very festive. And I also like to have something that's not a cookie on my platter, either a little bit of spiced nuts or some shards of toffee or a little truffle, just something to kind of break up all the cookiness. But yeah, mix and match and have some diversity, and it'll make for a really beautiful and delicious cookie platter.
What are some of your other favorite cookies to make and maybe advice on making them to go alongside those sugar cookies?
Oh, sure. You know, if you're thinking of chocolate cookies, there's chocolate crackles is a popular one. That's a dark chocolate with a powdered sugar coating, and then as it bakes, it kind of melts down and has a crackly appearance, and that's a standard favorite. People love the thumbprint cookies, and you can do those in all manners of flavors. You can have a jam thumbprint with a little bit of strawberry jam in the top, or people will put in a Hershey's Kiss or a little dab of ganache for their thumbprint cookie. I also really love shortbread. It's nice to have something that's has a nice defined shape, and it's real dense and not too sweet, but very buttery. I have a brown sugar whole wheat shortbread that I like to make, and there's lots of other really nice shortbread recipes out there. It's nice to have a bar cookie, and there's all manners of different types of bar cookies, ones that have lots of nuts and pretzels and crunchy things, and that adds a lot of texture to your plate. But really, if your butter's not too soft and you don't overbake things, and you're using good ingredients, you're not going to go wrong. Also, if you're going to make a new cookie, make sure you're using it from a well-tested source. There's so many opportunities out there to get recipes, and some I find are very good and well-tested, and others not so much. So it's nice to go to a source that has a lot of well-tested recipes.
What about cookies that have to travel? And what I'm thinking about are cookies you might make up a gift pack for family members. You might take them with you on a trip. They're in the trunk of the car. There's something like that. Are there any particular kind that are going to wind up in one piece like the way they left home?
You know, there's sturdy, and then there's cookies that don't dry out. And I think a good combination of the two is again, the shortbread. It's really rich. Shortbread has a lot of butter, so it's not going to dry out and honestly still tastes really great a week or two after you make them, if they actually last that long. and they're pretty sturdy as well. So shortbread is a nice one to pack up and either mail or take with you in the car.
So any thoughts in our last minute or so on non-cookies, other good things to bake around the holidays? What else do you have planned maybe for a holiday meal?
Oh, sure. Oh, other than sweets?
Other than the cookies, yeah.
Other than the cookies, sure. Well, I like to do a big Christmas brunch, and we'll do breakfast, and we'll have a big fruit salad. We'll have cinnamon rolls, which are sweet, but that's always a big part of it. I like to do an oven-baked bacon glazed with a little bit of cayenne and honey. And, you know, we'll probably have a ham at some point during that day as well.
Oven-baked bacon glazed?
Yes.
Wow. That's all we can say.
You had us a glazed bacon there. Yeah.
And to turn you back to the cookies really quick, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel annually does a holiday cooking contest where people turn in their best family recipes, and we got a lot of really good ones this year. And this year they put them all together in an ebook, so you can get all the past year's winner if you go to jsonline.com/ebook.
Ooh, do we know what the winner was on that yet?
Yes, it was an Italian fig cookie. So it's a sugar cookie with a little bit of frosting stuffed with this wonderful filling that had fig and coffee and lemon juice and brown sugar. It was really delicious.
Wow, that sounds great for the season.
Yeah.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us. A lot of fun, as always.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
To you, too.
Bye-bye.
That was Anna Thomas-Bates. She's a freelance writer. She blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com and writes for the Journal Sentinel's food section.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we're going to be talking to an expert about the most popular baby names from 2013.
We'll see if the movies and TV shows are big influences. Katniss's from the Hunger Games, maybe.
Possibly.
Arya from Game of Thrones.
I'm still hoping for Eugene to make that big comeback.
Someday, yeah. Man. Your day will come. We'll also hear the story behind a hard-to-find particle that could hold the secret of the universe.
And we'll be asking a science teacher our most burning questions about how everyday stuff works.
We'll also keep on top of the news of the day. That's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, does the U.S. Constitution need a rewrite? Our guest says the founders never intended the Constitution to be a sacred document. It's time to make some changes. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.